Looking for a graduation gift to inform, inspire, and encourage? When you give a subscription to Christianity Today, you're giving redemptive, relevant news and thoughtful, balanced dialogue about the church, current issues, and public theology. Visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to get a discounted student subscription for the graduates in your life. Starting at only $2 per month, this gift will engage and grow their faith throughout the year. Click the link in the show notes or visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to order now.
Because people are making an eternal decision based on misinformation that's been presented as fact. So we're presenting all of these biblical figures as white. We're presenting all of the African church fathers and philosophers and theologians. Tertullian was African. Cyprian was African. Perpetual Felicity, they were African. Augustine, African. Origen, African. Chanute of Atreep, African. All of them presented as white. And so what I found was when I would say something, I was called a race baiter or a critical race theorist, and it doesn't matter. I'm like, why doesn't race matter when you keep using race in your favor?
This is Where You're From, an origin story podcast at the intersection of faith and culture that digs into the influences and experiences that shape who we are today. Join us as we gain insight into the Bible's wisdom for all, regardless of where we're from. Hey y'all, this is Rasul Berry. Thanks for joining me on Where You're From. This week, I want to share my conversation with Pastor Jerome Gay. Jerome is the founder and president of The Urban Perspective, an author of several books, and serves as the lead pastor of Teaching and Vision at Vision Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. He has a passion for raising up gospel-centered churches and leaders within the urban context. I'm also excited to talk to Jerome because along with his brother Malik, we are co-editors of the book and video series, The Whole Man, from the Voices collection of Our Daily Bread Ministries. You can find out more about Pastor Jerome and The Whole Man Project by clicking the links in the show notes or by visiting whereyourfrom.org. That's where, Y-A, from.org. Please join me as I ask Pastor Jerome Gay, where you're from?
Southeast Washington, D.C.
Okay, so one thing, and I lived in D.C. for a little bit, so I'm a little familiar. It's probably one of the only cities I know where that particular quadrant deal. First of all, you can get lost really easy if you could take 7th Street.
Yeah, very easy.
And you're not sure which one. But what do you think is the significance of the adding the Southeast to the D.C.?
Yeah, the quadrants matter because even though it's one district, the right. District of Columbia, you have those pockets. So Southeast, you had H.D. Woodson, Fletcher Johnson, Middle School, and certain aspects of Go-Go as well, primarily kind of credited Northeast, Northwest. And so you just kind of had those distinctions for the culture. So like Uptown,
right.
A lot of clubs and things like right. that, Southeast, rough, all of it had certain rough pockets. And so you just kind of begin to claim your quadrant. Southeast is where I'm from and where I'm proud to be from.
Gotcha. So tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Southeast.
Yeah, man. So it was rough. I mean, it was rough. The part of Southeast I grew up in was called Simple City. That was the nickname. I grew up in a part called The Circle. And it gotten so bad that the National Guard had to come to our neighborhood just with the violence, the shooting, wow. the killings, all the things happening. We would have beef with a community not far called Eastgate. Sometimes even right up the street, Alabama Avenue from where I grew up, you know, you would have shootouts. And so there was constant friction. There were great times, too, when we'd do block parties and the fire hydrant and you had waters and you had the ice cream truck would come around. So it's not all this bleak example sure. of my city. But then, of course, Go-Go. So Chuck Brown, the creator, founder, inventor of Go-Go, you would frequently have either Rare Essence, Junkyard, Backyard are kind of the big bands, but you also had up and coming bands. Mm-hmm. Never a lack of having music, a show or a party at any given time.
And that's kind of a unique thing, especially growing up in the era of hip hop, that there was yeah. this very unique sound that was happening in D.C. called go-go music.
Yeah, because we would just take a song and then add congos and almost kind of a Caribbean feel, but it didn't right. sound that way. But right. the elements that you would yeah. find in Caribbean music,
horns,
you would find that the horns, the go-go, obviously the drums.
Right.
And so you would take that studio version, right. make it live. Add the congo, slow the tempo down, and you had go-go.
Nice.
Classic, man.
So how did your parents end up in Southeast D.C.?
Yeah, so pretty much born and raised. I was born in Walter Reed Hospital in D.C. My mom was from the area. My dad was from the area as well.
Right.
And then gave birth to me in May 24th, 1979.
All right.
And we lived in D.C., moved to Kansas because my dad was in the military, then moved back to D.C.
Okay. So, and which is another thing that's interesting, by the way, D.C. is the only place that I know where consistently when people tell you that they're born there, they mention the specific hospital. Did you notice that?
Now that you said something, I do recall that. Yeah, people
like,
kind of
I was
know.
Waiting for it in my mind. Like, is he going to do it? And you did not disappoint.
Yes, yes. I got to keep the track record going.
Exactly.
There.
So you mentioned your dad was in the military. So you moved from D.C. to Kansas.
Yeah.
So that's not go-go music and Alabama Avenue.
You talk about a culture shock. D.C. is called Chocolate City for a reason, right? Just a high demographic of black folk.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Junction City, Kansas, which let's say just a low percentage of black people. But, you know, we met great people. During that time, I had a best friend, a guy by the name of Michael Westenmeyer. Mm. That's when we moved to Fort Riley. So we moved from Junction City to
Fort
Riley.
How old were you around at this time?
Man, probably between the ages of like 8 up to my 10 years. Right. So we stayed there about 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So here's interesting. Literally the first day, meaning we're unpacking.
Right.
When we moved to Junction City, I go outside, just kind of meet some people, and a kid gets nose to nose in my face and says, "You listen here, N-word, this here is my neighborhood."
Wow.
That was my introduction to Kansas. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm from Southeast D.C. I punch the kid. I kick him. Then all of a sudden, we hear bang at the door, bang at the door. To my surprise, there's a big black dude there with the kid who just called me the N-word behind me. So he's like, "Man, your son hit my son." And I said, "Well, your son called me the N-word." Then he looked back. And then that was kind of
And that was it.
And so interesting, we ended up being on the same flag football team. We reconciled, worked through that. I mean, the kid had some stuff going on.
That is a
wild story. But that's what happened when I moved to Kansas. That was my introduction
now,
to Kansas.
Was that moment of racial discrimination, was that kind of a harbinger of things to come?
Unfortunately, it was. Now, I didn't allow that to cloud how I view all my white brothers and sisters, anything like that. But I also endured it from the teachers, where if something came up missing, they would look at me. I remember one student, I legitimately lost my quarter. I needed a quarter to get some lunch. And he gave me a quarter. And then when I went to pay for it, the teacher asked, did he take this from you? The kid who gave him the quarter, she asked that in front of me. Did he take this? Did he bully this? And he was like, "No, I just gave him the quarter so he can get some lunch." And so people don't know, like, when we talk about certain collective experiences, we're not making this up. Like, I didn't want to be accused of bullying a child just because of the color of my skin. Like, you didn't ask other people these questions. I didn't want my first couple of hours in Kansas for someone to get nose to nose and call me the N-word. I didn't invite these things.
Right.
They just happened. In hindsight now, my 40s, you know, you can look back on that and still see how God was shaping me through those things, although he didn't affirm it either, because that goes against us being created in his image. But you just learn, like, man, these are a lot of racial experiences that we do not invite, but we have to respond to.
Now, I'm also curious about how your family responded to you in that situation, you know, when the father's at the door and is explaining what's happening.
Yeah, so my mom answered the door, and I can't remember if I told her, because I'm just I want to fight. I'm good. And I'm not saved at this point either. So I'm like, "Hey, he got in my face. I'm from Southeast. You got in my face like you don't know me."
Right.
So I feel completely justified in what I did, especially because he used the N-word. So I explained, you know, what he did. So he kind of walked off. Then we ended up all getting together. We, you know, had to talk this through. And I'm like, "Yeah, man, you can't come at me like that."
Wow.
And obviously he was dealing with some frustration, because obviously that was his stepdad, you know, his biological father's white. So the interracial relationship that his mom had with his stepdad, and he had some issues with that. And again, I know how to use trauma and things like that, or not processing things now. But again, we're both talking about 8 or 9 going through this. And it was just an interesting experience, man.
Yeah. And he didn't conjure that up from his own self. He didn't make that word up. He probably had people even teasing him about his own family
about his stepdad, N-word lover in terms of his mom.
Wow.
And so we just have to look at these things and say, this stuff is taught. We don't excuse it. We need to combat it. We need to go at it. But children just naturally in these diverse settings don't hate each other.
No.
They're taught this stuff.
Right.
And that's why it's something that we should combat ferociously.
Okay. How long were you in Kansas?
About 5 years.
Okay. So what else do you remember about your time there that was formational?
So more pleasant. Let's I remember the skating rink. Mm. You know, we used to go skating all the time.
Right.
Southern schools are different, man. They took us rifle shooting.
Mm-hmm.
In elementary school, I'm like, what? I'm not exaggerating this. We're shooting these rifles. They got the little, you know, the paper thing, the target for us. Like, think about in today's climate, right. You know, you never do that. So those were some experiences that I wouldn't have gotten in D.C., especially just with the gun violence happening there.
Right.
But it's a completely different setting. So the skating ring, you know, shooting, the field trips at different parts. I was a minority, so all of my friends were diverse. Hmm. You know, so we, again, racism, things like that are taught. Like, we're just having fun. We're just trying to play Nintendo, go to the skating rink together, go to the mall together, and just build relationships and dream about what our future is going to be. So
it sounds like by the end of your time there, you would come to appreciate and enjoy your time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Overall, I would say yes. Okay. Overall, I would say yes. I mean, you don't want to experience everything, but you can look and like, hey, I'm not going to let this define my entire 5 years.
Got it.
So there were a lot of good times as well.
So what caused there to be another move back to D.C.?
Yeah, so my dad was in the military. He served his time. But once we got back to D.C., I always talk about that long road down Benning Road in Southeast D.C. where you have this landmark that everyone knows about is the Shrimp Boat. And the Metro Center is right there. Mm-hmm. And my dad, we take this long walk. Then he talks to me about his struggle with drugs. And that confession is something that I thought was just going to be a confession, like, hey, this is something from his past, but it was a present struggle. And then that would proceed for decades on end past that time, because I think I was around 13 when he shared that with me. And so then it began all to kind of make sense with us moving around, even when we got back to D.C., moving and have to relocate because we did not have any financial stability because of his habit.
What do you remember about that moment in terms of what was going through your mind and your emotions?
It's weird. I remember it so vividly. I remember I had on like a plaid shirt, the jeans I had on, the first pair of Jordans I got, and I was eating Doritos. Mm. I remember those things because it was such a pivotal conversation.
And what was your relationship like with your dad to that point?
He was my hero. Mm-hmm. You know, he's in the military. You know, he's serving our country. These are the things. And so
your name,
I knew I'm named. Yeah, I'm a junior. He's the senior. And my son is the third, mm-hmm. you know, so keeping that name still going. But that walk changed how I saw him, that he's human, that he doesn't have it all together, that there are some issues there. And then I just began to learn his story and the abuse he encountered. And the way he was treated and threatened and abused and tortured. So, you know, my dad endured a lot of stuff, aspects of his life. So I always say this when I preach, this is an explanation, not an affirmation. Mm. So I'm not affirming the decisions he's made, but I do understand and I'm able to explain some of the trauma he endured that led him to try to use drugs to escape.
Wow.
That trauma that he was encountering.
And how did you know about those things?
He ended up telling me. My mom would tell me just about these things, some of the things that he endured, some of the ways he was threatened by his siblings and some of the things that he went through. Mm. It's like when you go through that, you know, it affects you mentally.
Yeah.
We have terms on processing healthily and counseling and all these things. But you're talking about, I'm born in 79. You're talking about the late 80s, early and mid 90s. Mm. And he's trying to figure all this out himself while still trying to raise me. Keep in mind, my mom's 16 when she has me. So you talk about teen parents.
Wow.
So all of these things when I was born, he was older than that by the time we had that conversation when I'm 13. But just putting all that together, again, it gives me an explanation of the trauma he encountered. I still don't affirm what he did.
Right.
And he still has a responsibility, every man does, to his family. But it allows me to extend grace, extend a certain level of grace to say, again, I don't excuse it, but I understand.
So you see him as more human. That's not a conversation that a lot of people who have any type of substance abuse is having with their 13-year-old son.
Right.
But there's also the sense of hope. But then you say, at the end of that conversation on Benning Road, you thought he was sharing about something that was in the rear view mirror.
Yeah. Yeah.
When did you discover, oh, no, this isn't just something that's in the past, but it's in the present with us?
Just having to live, when you have to live with an addict and you see how they treat you. You see how they are when they're under the influence. You know, like, this isn't the same person. They're night and day when they're not high versus when they're high. And so I remember, you know, at the time, we had this system called the Sega CD. That was like top tier, you know what I mean? Family got me that. And then coming home and he had pawned it. My Timberlands, he pawned those things. You're coming home and these things are no more. I remember we walked in and we saw that stuff was gone, and my mom just broke down in tears because she knew what had happened, that this was going again towards his habit. And so when you have to live through that, you never feel a sense of stability. And for me, it caused me to become what I call an anti-visionary. And what an anti-visionary is, someone, you're clear on what you don't want to be and who you don't want to be, but that's still not a vision of who you need to be. Right. So I knew what I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be like him. And I even hated that an example of what not to be is my dad for me. And so having to process that, like, I don't want to be like him. I don't want to have my kids moving around. I don't want to be pawning stuff, right? There was some self-righteousness on my part in terms of how I viewed him and how I judged him. But going through that, it caused me to be this anti-visionary and to become extremely performance-driven and competitive. So I'm always competing. So I could be competing against you. You don't even know we're competing. In my head, I'm winning, because when you experience those things, you have to win. And then internally, there's a struggle where you're asking, am I that hard to love? Now, again, knowing the mechanics of addiction now, he's not consciously saying, I'm picking this over my children. But again, as a young kid, that's how I'm processing it. So I'm trying to find my identity in achievement, trying my identity in women, trying to find my identity in sports, in anything where I can feel like I'm getting a W. That's what I began to run towards.
Well, and what were some of those W's that you saw getting accolades for, or that helped you feel like this sense of I'm winning?
Yeah. So let me back up. So funny enough, though, God used my dad, because he made my mom and I go to the church where I would trust Christ. Like, he wouldn't go, but he would tell us to go, because we end up moving to this place called the Fox Club, and we end up moving right across the street from a converted, I think it was a Safeway. Safeway is a grocery store chain. We end up going there, and that's where I hear the gospel.
Wow.
And how I hit a gospel. I think I'm about 13 and I hit a gospel and I respond to it. When I go to the altar to get saved, the pastor whispers in my ear, "Preacher, man." So he prophesies that I'm going to be a pastor when I get saved. Now, again, my theology is, I came up here to get Jesus and sit down. I ain't come up here for no prophecies. I didn't come up here for any of this.
But at the time, why was Jesus attracted to you?
Because he was talking about performance-less love. And so he's saying that this love is not based on your performance, because he died before you performed anything. And subconsciously, I was thinking, I have to prove my value. I got to prove my value. I got to earn my value, because, again, in the back of my head, well, he doesn't want me. He's choosing this over me. So I have to somehow conjure up my value. So this is how salvation is connected. End up joining an organization called Rites of Passage, and I find out that I have a speaking gift. Like, they have me speaking and people respond when I speak. And so, again, after this prophecy, I'm beginning to see these things kind of play out. I'm somewhat fighting the prophecy. I'm like, I don't have it in my plans to be pastoring anyone. But this is what was spoken over me. And I begin to see certain aspects of my gifting as it relates to that affirmed. And it was affirmed not in the church context. These are high school kids encouraging me on my ability to speak, and people feel compelled by how I put words together.
So you got exposed to the Rites of Passage program in high school.
We're at Suitland High School. Yep. Okay. Suitland Rams, baby. 97, class of 97.
There it is. Now, you mentioned that wasn't in your plans. What were your plans in terms of how you saw your future and what you would be doing?
I thought I was going to go into broadcasting. I wanted to be on the news, eventually have my own talk show, produce.
Got it.
Have an on and off of the camera presence as it relates to production and media.
Got it.
So that was my plan, but clearly God had other plans.
Okay, so you're in this Rites of Passage program.
Yeah.
What was that like, and what is a Rites of Passage for them?
Yeah, so it was an all-male organization in high school where the focus was positivity, empowerment, and activism. And so we were learning these things from some of the older men that worked at the school. Some of them were coaches, some of them were teachers, some of them were substitute teachers. Sometimes they were bringing entrepreneurs. And they would just encourage us to be men of distinction and not to go with the crowd. And so we would have different projects. We would reenact things. We would do stuff for the school. Certain times we would have topics when you would speak. And there was a guy who was more gifted than me. This is just me speaking, a guy named Anthony Davis. And seeing him speak always inspired me too. And then I found out that he was a Christian and he was bold and he was unapologetic about his faith, even in high school. Like, look, I'm serious about my sexual purity. I'm not out here trying to do this. I'm serious about the calling of God on my life. And having him as an example as well just kind of spurred me on.
And how unique at the Suitland Rams, Suitland High School, was it to have this guy in Anthony Davis be this bold about his faith?
It was God's providence. You just heard about performance-less love. Right. You don't need performance-based love. You're not the only believer at this school. You just so happen to join this organization. Here it is, another brother that does have his family together, but he's unapologetic about his faith. And the part I left out is I wasn't supposed to go to Suitland because we still lived in Southeast D.C. So I'm catching two trains and a bus to school, two trains and a bus back.
Wow.
Because of just all of the violence and stuff happening in Southeast, my mom did not want me to go to any school in Southeast, didn't have the money to send me to a private school. So she was like, you going to a school in Maryland, and just for her own peace of mind. And God worked even through that.
Now, at this point, I'm imagining with some of this strain happening at home that your dad doesn't lived there the entire time when you're in high school.
Yeah, so a pivotal part of our story, man. He was there, like in and out. And I always want to make it clear because I don't want to paint him as if he was never there. That's not the case. He did work hard. He tried to provide. You know, he wasn't into sports. My dad was into cooking and like science and a Discovery Channel type of guy. That's my dad, which impacted me as well because I have some of those tendencies as well. But a pivotal moment was I got this cut on my hand right here. It's a thick cut where the hustlers from the neighborhood were playing with machetes, playing with real machetes. And so I'm starting to kind of talk to them and hang around them. I'm not fully in that because my mom, even my dad, even with his own habit, like, you don't want nothing to part of that. And I get cut and it cuts all the way to the bone, like the white part with the machete. I get cut. So I'm just bleeding profusely. It's like dripping out. Blood is all over my hand. And this cut is still there. And so I walk in and then my dad was there and he starts asking me like, how you doing and what's going on? What happened? And for some reason that day I had it with my dad. And I said, don't try to be a father now. We get in a shouting match. I mean, like, that's the first time my dad, I would say, hit me. He slapped me because we're shouting. I'm like, don't try to be a father. He slapped me. And I was like, get out. Like, we don't need you. We're just verbally screaming, going back and forth. And I kind of let out all the things that I was feeling emotionally. Like, now is not the time because you haven't been here. You haven't been a father. You've been in and out. And he left. He left. And my mom clapped. It was like the family clapped because I stood up. And so that was.
Oh, like applauded.
Applaud. You. Like applauding me for standing up to my dad of just about what was going on because of the turmoil that was happening because he wasn't free at that time from his addiction. And so that's a pivotal part of my story.
How did you feel about that once you kind of calmed down and the moment had passed?
It was weird because I thought my mom would probably start like, don't talk to him like that. And I didn't like cuss at my dad like that. But I was just letting him know, like, in a way, really saying we need you to be healthy. And your presence here isn't that. Like, you're bringing instability, uncertainty with your presence. Wow. And because of your addiction. Like, he's a funny guy, great sense of humor. Like, I get certain things from him. But I can say, hey, I see this in my dad. Right. Even with his issues, I see certain aspects of me that I get from him.
Right.
So once I put him out, so to speak, he was never really back.
Okay.
And he hasn't been back since. Now, we still stay in contact, but I mean, that was a pivotal moment for me, for our family, and then for him as well.
So from there, what's the next step in your development?
So now let's fast forward 97, graduate from Suitland High School. As a part of that prophecy that I did not want when I got saved, I had applied to several schools, got accepted to several schools. The only school I applied to in North Carolina was St. Augustine's College in Southeast Raleigh, North Carolina. So I'm like, well, I had this prophecy over me at 13. At 16, I felt like I heard the Holy Spirit saying, go to North Carolina and plant a church. And again, I'm 16. I know I'm not going to do this as a teenager. And I knew I wasn't going to do that at 18 either. But I'm like, well, this is the only place I applied to, so I guess I got to go there. Literally the first day I have a Bible study and people get saved. The first day after unpacking, saying bye to mom, crying, all that, I have a Bible study the very first day. Something about first days. Kansas first day wasn't pleasant, but this first day at St. Aug was pleasant. So I ended up starting a ministry, starting a step team, starting different things there at the school. I meet my wife there. She's from Wilson, North Carolina. We end up having a psychology class together. Get married right after I graduate in July of 01. So I'm married at 22.
Wait, I just got... How do you start a Bible study your first day of school? Like, how does that even work?
I went in the lobby, just told some people, hey, we're going to open up the scriptures. And if you want to come, and some people came and joined us. Just men and women came and we walked through the scriptures and... I remember the gospel. I knew the gospel. I knew how to share what Christ had done.
Wow.
And so just shared that and some people got saved.
I mean, amazing. And so it seemed like that leadership, that prophecy had spoken to you, that Anthony Davis had, you know, rites of passage spoken, like you're now kind of walking into this.
Yeah. Yeah.
As you're on your own in college.
Yeah. In college, I accepted it. And I knew then, like, hey, I'm called to ministry.
Right.
So I had a plan, and part of that plan was I'm not dating anybody my first 2 years.
Right.
I wasn't a virgin. I'd already lost my virginity, and I'm extreme in whatever I do. So if I go down this road with women, the God is powerful enough, but I don't know when I'm going to come back.
Right.
So I'm not dating anybody. I just want to focus on school and ministry, and that's what I did.
When we come back, Pastor Jerome will share how he dove into church ministry after college and grew a church from 70 people to 20. That's coming next on Where You're From.
This episode is brought to you by Church Salary. Coming up with a reasonable salary range for church staff has never been easy. There are so many details to consider before setting compensation for church staff, and you're probably asking yourself questions like, are we paying too little or too much? What benefits do we offer employees? What's a reasonable housing allowance? Church Salary believes that offering competitive and fair compensation helps keep people in ministry. Using the expansive church-specific compensation database and powerful salary calculator tool, you can also make better compensation decisions so your staff can focus on their ministries. Start with Church Salary's annual membership today to run unlimited customized reports and get access to our member-only content. Ready to start making better compensation decisions? Get started at churchsalary.com.
Hey, y'all, before we get back to my conversation with Pastor Jerome Gay, I wanted to share a quick teaser from our next episode with another one of our whole man contributors, Dr. Nee Addy. This is Where You're From.
As I've been in different environments, there are lots of people who've had intellectual or scientific oppositions to faith. But whenever I get to know those folks more, every single time, there's always something deeper. Someone will have gone through something in their life and they'll say something like, well, I have issues with the man upstairs.
Right.
Or why did this evil thing happen here? Why did I go through this really difficult situation? So there's always something beneath the surface. That
right.
There was an intellectual aspect of it, but I think God was also showing me that people are hurting
right.
and have been through things and that I also need to be able to kind of meet them where they're at. And he's actually opened up opportunities where I've been able to bring people through God's help back into relationship with God.
To learn more about the Whole Man book and video series, go to experiencevoices.org/wholeman. That's experiencevoices.org/wholeman. Now let's get back to our conversation with Pastor Jerome Gay on Where You're From.
You seem to have this very unique focus, drive. Where do you think that came from?
Now, that's my mom. My mom has a determination. Mm. She has a focus. She has an aggression, an assertiveness about her. And then a work ethic. She would wake up, have an Orange Juice Jones plan. I saw you and him walking in the rain. Yeah, she got that plan. While she's ironing her clothes and mine for the week, for the entire week. And she's consistently doing this. So I'm learning work ethic, think ahead, plan ahead, focus in, try to think about things that probably won't happen, but be prepared in case it does. Wow.
Now, you said for 2 years you had committed, I'm not going to be in any kind of dating situation.
Yep.
So is it year three that you meet this special?
Well, I met Crystal before then, but we don't start making it official to my junior year.
Right.
Her senior year.
Okay.
So she's 2 years older than me.
Right.
So she finished before me. But yeah, she had asked me to go to coordination with her. And I remember before that, ironing my stuff. And I heard the Lord say she's the one.
Wow.
Heard the Lord say she's the one. And I think part of that being able to hear him is because I had detoxed myself from dating.
Mm.
Like I just don't want my judgment clouded by a girl right now. Mm. So I just need to go all, like Paul talked about, you know, the unmarried man's attention is undivided.
Now that's interesting. You said she invited you to something. So who made the first move about?
So this is what we argue about. But since she ain't got the mic. So people tried to set us up.
Okay.
So they called me Funky Rev. That was my nickname.
Wait.
Funky Rev. Yeah, edit that out.
Why Funky Rev?
No, so a guy named Lil T from Southeast, real name Timothy Cummins, but Lil T from Southeast, just one day said, I'm going to start calling you Funky Rev. That's how he said it, Funky Rev. And then one day, him and a guy named Tony, Anthony Warg, was like, Rev, we got somebody for you.
Mm.
But this is still during my detox phase. So I'm like, nah.
Okay.
But I ended up meeting her in the student union. We played pool together. Then we had a psychology class. And again, later on, the Lord had confirmed it. But I'm like, I'm not doing anything until I feel released.
Okay. Now, where did the two versions diverge of the story?
So she thinks in a psychology class, I was trying to flirt with her.
Okay.
That's what she would say. Okay. I was trying to flirt with her. Because those books were expensive, like $180.
Mm.
So we shared her book.
Got it.
And I'm like, I genuinely just
needed
wanted to share. Yeah, I needed the book.
And she ain't
she's
buying.
Like, nah, she's not buying it.
Now, what was it about her that made these other folks say she's for you?
Yeah, I didn't know at the time, but she had recently gotten saved and she's trying to focus on her walk with Christ.
Okay.
She's not trying to hop into something toxic or, you know, be distracted from her walk with the Lord.
Right.
And that was attractive to me. Just like, hey, someone who's focused. I mean, it was physical attraction, but just seeing that. And I'm already praying. So one of the aspects I tell people when you're looking for somebody is watch them without them knowing. Hmm. So that way you're not getting a publicist. You're not getting a false version of who they are.
Right.
So I just watched her. But I didn't let her know. Mm. I just watched how she lived, watched how she operated. And that's how the attraction.
And you're not talking about stalking.
No, not stalking. No, I mean, no. Amen. No
just,
stalking.
Just observing.
I mean, observing her life. Observing her life.
Got it.
Yeah.
And you saw consistency. You saw, you know, something. Okay. So y'all graduate.
We got married July 21st, 2001.
Right after you graduated.
Well, 2 months. Graduated in May.
Okay.
2 months later, I am married.
Okay. And so you had previously sensed God's calling to start a church in Raleigh.
Yeah.
Where you had gone to St. Augustine.
Yeah.
So where does this fit now into your plan of starting the church?
No, yeah, I wasn't ready then. I mean, I was 22. So, I mean, I had a, by God's grace, enough sense. Like, I don't need to be planting a church at 22 years old. We did still have, like, a ministry where we were just a group of people that were with us. So, on campus, I again, this is you for ambition. I would never call a ministry this now, but on campus, we called the ministry Thugs Ministries. Thug stood for Together Helping Us Grow Spiritually. I thought it was innovative. I thought it was awesome.
We thugs.
Thugs Ministry. I would never do that now, but Thugs Ministry, Together Helping Us Grow Spiritually. But then we changed to Adoration Ministry, so that goes a lot better.
Right.
Imagine inviting your friends, hey, go meet the thugs. I think I'm going to pass. So Adoration Ministries, and we do that for a while. Then I end up linking up with an older guy. He's about 10 years older than me, and we form a church called Servants for Christ. And I served there about 5 to 6 years.
So while you were newlywed, 2001, so before this Servants of Christ, what are you doing full time?
So I'm working for Verizon Wireless. managing a store.
Okay.
Then I went from there, I ended up transitioning to the loan industry. So doing home mortgages.
Okay.
Both of these are just being bivocational. Like while I'm in ministry,
right.
I'm not a lead pastor at this point, but while I'm doing those things, I was working in that industry.
Sounds like everything is just moving along quite smoothly, just checking off the box, no problems or conflicts.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. So again, the Servants for Christ thing, that ended up blowing up, man. So the guy I was with, he made some decisions where the church split. And so now I'm 28, trying to lead people through a church split.
So you're saying it's because of the decisions he made, there was a sharp difference. Now, was it like, were people looking to you to lead or was it?
Some were. I mean, some people were just done and left. And then there was a few that stayed, and I just renamed it Servants for Christ to VIC, Vision International Church. And I ended up doing that for 5 years before I began to seek some relationships of like-minded people who had gospel centrality, biblical orthodoxy, serious about missions and serving their neighborhoods. So from that, then I ended up planting Vision Church in 2010.
So when you say plant, because you were already leading a church named Vision, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Plant.
So VIC was the rename of a church that it was handed to me as a result of a split. It was like, hey, there's a lot of hurt and pain associated with that name.
Got it.
So let me just rename it. And here's what we're going to be about.
And start from scratch.
And I tried to. But, you know, people are not going to forget what happened. So there wasn't a clear break.
Right.
And I could just see a lot weren't going to get past it. So that's why I like, hey, guys, we're dropping the I. It's just going to be Vision Church. This is the type of church we're going to be. And we grew it from 70 to 20. grew it from 70 to 20.
What do you, like, in that moment, right? What's going on in your inner world that's different than how you saw this going? Because you had had this vision at such a young age. Like, what's going through your mind and what are you wrestling with in the midst of this conflict?
Right? Yeah, I mean, in college, for the most part, I felt like it was. And right. So now everything doesn't go as planned.
Right.
Because, you know, in college, I said, I'm not going to date, going to get married here. Yeah. We're going to wait 3 years to have our kids. All of that literally happened as planned. Mm-hmm. But once I got into the ministry, it's like, yeah, God is showing me you're pastoring people. Nothing goes as planned. Mm. People leave. People say they're with you and then they're not. People change. People's theology change. Some people who say they believe don't. Mm. So we didn't use the term back then, but, you know, people deconstruct from the faith. So now ministry just showed me how fickle people are, including me. Mm. I changed. Mm. I grew. There were areas of growth. You know, I've matured as a pastor and as a leader over the years. Mm. So just that, God allowed me to experience the ups and downs of ministry, and the uncertainty is what makes you walk by faith and not by sight.
We had a conversation talking about the Whole Man Project where you got very animated in reflecting on Psalm 77.
Yeah.
What resonates with you about Psalm 77 and maybe even in this particular season in your life?
Yeah. So you have these Psalms of Asaph, and Asaph is considered a good singer and poet. But this one, the psalmist has taken the journey from grief to gratitude. And so he talks about in the psalm, will God's anger last forever? Has God forgotten compassion? But then he says something important. He says, I think of God and I groan. Mm. So, you know, what do you do when God is your problem? And he answers that subsequently, you go to God with your problems. Mm. So he's still going to God, processing his pain. And I've learned to do that over the years from just being a son, husband, father, and pastor, being able to say, I'm not okay. And I'm mad at you, God, because you're all powerful, but you allowed this to happen. And I know I may never understand how somehow this is going to work out for my good, or somehow you're going to get glory out of this. But that's what you see in that psalm.
That is a very deep insight and reaction. Where do you think that came from, that approach? Because that's not how everybody responds to those type of moments of crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. Jude talks about that his desire for the church is that they will be built up in their faith. Then he says, praying in the spirit. And what he means by that is just being spirit led as you're spending time in the word of God. And so that's been the source for me, right? The word of God is referred to as milk. but it's also referred to as solid food. So it represents growth. It's a sword. It's called in Ephesians 6. So it's something that I can battle with. It's sharper than any two-edged sword in Hebrews, right? So it cuts both ways. It talks about bone and marrow. So not only does it cut the person, it cuts me. So time in his word and all the things his word represents lets me know how much I need it, how much I need to be cut by it, right, and how that's going to be the source and the foundation. So just time in the word and prayer. Man, prayer, man.
And what has Crystal's role been in the development and shaping of you as a person and a leader?
Yeah, man, I could do none of this without her. She is God's gift to me. She is a gift of grace. She's my boo, my everything. And so even just being here, right? Like, I'm able to do that because I have a wife that believes in the vision God has for our family, but also his call on my life. Mm. And I tell couples this, you know, she's not like a female version of me. She's not trying to be a teacher. She's a behind the scenes person. But when the Bible talks about God says to Adam, I will make a helper suitable. Mm. A lot of people don't know this. That word suitable is the Hebrew word neged, and it means opposite. God knows that you don't need somebody like you. What's suitable is someone different than you. Mm. Their approach, their personality.
Yeah.
So she's my neged. She's my opposite yet suitable help to do what I do.
And I love that. And somebody else we've had on here, Carolyn Custis James, talks about Azer is the word translated helper. And there's like this warrior dynamic to Azer, where when God is a helper, then the other part of scripture, it means that he's your help, like in the midst of a battle.
Yeah.
And it seems like Crystal has kind of been that type of shoulder.
So,
in that moment of that crisis from the church dynamic, how was she supporting you in that way?
So in our dining room, we have a picture up, and the picture was drawn by a guy led to Christ. The guy's name is Asian Wade. He used to draw these very demonic pictures of demons raping women. He's a very brilliant artist, though. I mean, like, it was clear. He used to draw this demonic stuff. Used to get drunk and high, and we ended up crossing paths. I shared the gospel with him, and he gets saved. I bring that up because he drew that picture, and it's a picture of Crystal and I wearing the armor of God. So she got her full armor of God, but it's like a skirt. I got the armor of God, but we're both holding the sword. It's one sword. And that's a reminder of the oneness that we have. Mm. It's one shield that we're to guard each other. And so she's been in the trenches, all the ups and downs of me personally, but also through the church. And so we have that reminder in our dining room. It's like, we are together fighting the enemy. I want to fight with you. I don't want to fight against you.
Wow.
And so it's just a visual reminder of that. And so I tell people, tell guys in particular, wisdom is personified as female in scripture.
That's
wisdom
right.
is personified as female. Yep. So recognize that when God is speaking through your wife, he could be speaking a word of wisdom that you need to take heed to, but you're so busy doing the will of God that you're actually ignoring it when he speaks to your wife.
And that's sometimes when that two-edged sword cuts in some ways that aren't.
Yeah. You know, the wife is going to say, go ahead, pastor. She's going to throw the title in my face.
So you now kind of rebuilt, relaunched. How did that feel?
So that's just, again, man, you talk about like depression, and you don't start a vision for it to fail.
Hmm.
You don't see that.
Right.
God does allow that. He shapes, he uses what we seemingly look at as failure to form.
Hmm.
And so me and a guy named Ray Bolawifa, we were the elders, and we were like, hey, man, if God closed the doors, he closes the doors. But by God's grace, you know, that 20 began to grow. And now here we are, you know, 13 years and counting with a location and over 120 kids coming every week, several hundred adults coming. And again, I don't want guys to think, because not everyone's going to experience 500 plus people, right? Be faithful where you are. Mm. I had to be faithful with the 20.
Mm. But it's one thing to be faithful with 20 when you start with 10.
Yeah.
It's another thing to be faithful with 20 when you had 50, right?
Yeah. No, and I felt that. I don't want to act like no, but I realized, and again, in hindsight, because I believe you most aptly understand God's will in hindsight. He knows the end from the beginning. We don't. We're living it.
Right.
So in hindsight, God was pruning.
Mm.
God was pruning.
Wow.
And we were able to do more with a faithful 20 than a spectating 50 or 70. Mm. So God was using that. And again, he was stretching me. But the other thing was, he was revealing my numbers idolatry that I had to repent of.
Yeah.
And then even after that, when we grew to, we hit 100, and then I was like, I can't wait for us to get to 5. And God reminded me, hey, remember I kind of dwindled? Don't worry about the numbers. Just be faithful.
And it sounds like that numbers thing is going all the way back to that aspect of winning that you talked about, which could go all the way back to almost trying to fill this void of proving love or worth for somebody, you know, going all the way back to the challenges with your dad.
Yeah, so many pastors, and I tell them this, I said, don't let the pulpit be your "see, I made it" platform.
Wow.
Because then people become a means to an end. Mm. They become a means to making your platform, not God's people that need you to shepherd them.
Yeah.
And so it's so important that we just process our pain, man.
Yeah.
Pastors have pain. Pastors need counseling. Pastors need to process. Pastors need rest.
Okay. So this is this full, robust journey for you as a pastor, but you have a bunch of commas after what you do. So there's also author, right? When did that come to the surface as something that was going to be a part of your story and journey?
Yeah, I had been challenged and encouraged. So Dr. Mason, Blake Wilson, Brian LaRitz, and then even one of the guys that's an elder now that I discipled, Sandy Roberts, one of our elders, he would challenge me. A guy named Cale Grissett, who's one of our elders, all of them would encourage me, like, man, like, you need to make this stuff in the books. And there was just a fear there. And then a guy by the name of Timothy Johnson, he told me, hey, man, there's a company that kind of help you craft your sermons into a book. So that was my first one. Mm. Renewal, Grace and Redemption in the Story of Ruth. And so we did a sermon series called Renew. And once I did that, I told you, man, I'm extreme. So once I wrote that one, my second book, The Whitewashing of Christianity, A Hidden Past, A Hurtful Present, A Hopeful Future. That was the hardest one because I didn't have sermon content to pull from. I had to dig. I tell people 100 books went into that one book. Mm-hmm. So pulling from all the research and stuff. But then tons of rejection. Every single Christian publisher I did my proposal to rejected me for that book. Mm-hmm. Every last one of them. So here it is, rejection again. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a part of life. And so I ended up saying, all right, I'm just going to do it myself, and did it with Audrey Ori and 13th and Joan and got that out.
What was it about that topic, the whitewashing of Christianity, that made it so important for you to get that story out?
Yeah. So, and the numbers are still staggering, but just we've had about a 19% decline between Black and brown youth in the last 20 years. And one of the contributors
to church and Christianity.
And one of the contributors to that is whitewashing. And so they associate Christianity with slavery, because Ephesians 6:5, slaves obey your masters. And we haven't gotten out the right exegesis and hermeneutical perspective on that verse, because we've been bombarded with pictures of a white Jesus, 12 white disciples, white Moses, white Mary, white other Mary, white Moses's wife. And then they even made the Egyptians white. So it's like you just flooded with all these Middle Eastern people looking white. And so people begin to say, well, it seems like Christ will save us, but he won't use anyone that looks like us. Mm. And so I wanted the church to see this is an issue of eternity, because people are making an eternal decision based on misinformation that's been presented as fact. Mm. So we're presenting all of these biblical figures as white. We're presenting all of the African church fathers and philosophers and theologians. Tertullian was African. Cyprian was African. Perpetual Felicity, they were African. Augustine, African. Origen, African. Chanute of Atrebe, African. All of them presented as white. And so what I found was when I would say something, I was called a race baiter or a critical race theorist, or it doesn't matter. I'm like, why doesn't race matter when you keep using race in your favor? Mm. If it doesn't matter, why don't you show some diverse imagery in these people who have contributed to the faith? I wanted to give credence to the concerns of people who are walking away from the faith and say, hey, I want to agree with their concerns. Yes, Christianity has been whitewashed in its presentation, but I wanted to disagree with their conclusion, because their conclusion is Jesus is not for us. Mm. We need to go to African spirituality or some type of pluralism or polytheism, because Christ isn't for us. And that was why. It's like, we're called to depopulate hell. We're called to be salt and light. We're called to go and show people the good news of Christ. And if this is eclipsing his glory, we all should care, but not just Black Christians. We all should care about this because it doesn't accurately represent the mosaic that is the Christian faith, where God has used people of all hues in his plan of redemption.
That's great. One other thing, in addition to pastor, author, there's also podcaster.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the urban perspective. So yeah, the urban perspective, what I'm doing with that is, my contention for the church is, we're saying that there's one way, which I concur, that there's one God, I concur, and that there's one book. Again, I concur. We're saying that that's just one for 8 billion people. If we're going to make that claim, and we are, we need to be able to defend it. We should not make that claim that there's one book for 8 billion people and not be able to answer questions. And so we must stop giving faith-based answers to fact-based questions. So when people say Constantine created Christianity, that's false. I mean, 325, the Council of Nicaea had nothing to do with the creation of Christianity. But we need to at least be able to answer that question from a timeline perspective and call out people who are using anachronisms and getting the timelines wrong. So that's what that is. It's about helping Christians get equipped to know what they believe and why they believe it. And so that's what we're doing there.
Wow. So there's author, podcaster, father, husband.
Yeah.
And then there's this project that we kind of got locked into and leaned into together, the Whole Man Project.
Yeah.
Why did you want to be a part of that?
Man, when you reached out to me, it was like immediate. I prayed and got with the wife and said, babe, you know, Rasul reached out to me about this opportunity. I'm really excited about it because it's called Whole Man. And I had always felt like when it comes to men, the church is the only place where a man could go for 25 years, never grow, and we applaud just him attending. We applaud just attendance. And I said, that's because so many men don't even know what it means to be a man. And so with this project, where we're talking about the head, the mental health, the mental capacity, mental health of a man, the heart, the emotional capacity, emotional awareness and relationship, the hands, work and vocation. So many men stop here. They just go with hands and they neglect head and they neglect heart. They know to do something, do something, do something, do something. So there's always this doing but not being. But then we have the foundation of the soul. We're saying that you need all 4 foundational stones. Yes, as a man thinks, so is he, right? Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. Be doers of the word, not hearers only. That's the hands. But what's the foundation? The foundation of that is a relationship with Christ. That if you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart in the Lord Jesus, you will be saved. Jesus says in Mark 1:15, the time is fulfilled. The kingdom is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. So we want to come back to that gospel foundation so that we can have men that are mentally, emotionally, and relationally well and whole.
Man, I couldn't have said it better myself. And I think one of the things that I'm kind of curious to kind of circle back in light of wholeness that we've talked about involving reckoning with our emotions and even the things that have contributed to our past. Like, how do you think about that in relationship to your father? Where have things been since that fateful day on 16 when you had that moment?
Yeah, I think since I've gone through a journey of processing my own pain and being able to extend grace to him and even have to repent in some aspects of how I responded to him is to keep the lines of communication open. So we still talk. He texted me later this morning, good morning. And I'll respond to him. And we still talk from time to time. And again, what he's been saying is, hey, I've been clean for such and such time. I pray it's true because that's what I want for you. That your grandkids, my 2 children, like, they need you healthy. But I don't want you in a place where I have to shield you from them. So I want you healthy. I want you clean. I want you to be saved and living for God. And so we still talk. We still talk about the spirit. We talk about his health. We talk about his progress. We don't always agree, but just the Lord told me never cut him off. Like, that's the last thing he needs. So I'm still going to keep the line of communication open with Pops.
This is Where You're From. I'm Rasul Berry. And remember, it's not just about where you're at, it's also about where you're from. This show was produced by Ryan Clevenger and Mary Jo Clark. I also want to thank listeners Chris Gubril and Mike Ferrone for their help in supporting and promoting Where You're From. Thanks, y'all.
Where You're From is part of the Voices Collection
from Our Daily Bread Ministries.